Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, what does all three media have in common with the Daily Telegraph? While both may soon be in the hands of Jeff Zucker in billion-dollar buyouts. Meanwhile, it feels like Samir Shah is already BBC chair as he weighs into the latest Lineker controversy. Also on the programme, what kind of paywall is Mail Online building? And why is Future Publishing investing in critics and reviews? All that, plus in the media quiz, we play the only possible game we could with those Netflix stats. That's all to come in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, ChatGPT has bagged a deal to summarise Politico and Business Insider articles. Publisher Axel Springer called the deal with OpenAI the first of its kind. Nigel Farage has returned from the jungle with a message for Kevin Ligo, who joked about the I'm a Celeb star a few weeks ago. If you want to go to war with me, Farage said on his GB News show, it won't be very good for ITV's share price. The ITV boss has yet to comment. And the producers of The One Show had a scare on Wednesday evening when guests Stephen Fry and Sheridan Smith ended up stuck in a lift at New Broadcasting House. A warning for live broadcasters everywhere, maybe take the stairs. Now, joining me at the London Podcast Studios, we welcome back Faraz Osman. Hello, Faraz.
Hello, mate. How are you? Merry Christmas. I mean, I'd say Merry Christmas.
Absolutely.
It's December. We can say Merry Christmas.
It is. This is the Christmas episode.
Amazing. Oh, look, it's all the tinsel's out, isn't it?
So media's closing down this week because it is Christmas.
Media closed down at the beginning of the year. It doesn't ever open up again.
Is there any last minute rush, or are we really in the dog days of 2023?
Well, I mean, this time of year is always a little bit quieter, generally. Mm. It's a bleak time across the industry. You know, all joking aside, there's a lot of people, particularly in television, who have struggled this year and continue to struggle. And I think that there's not a... It would be nice if there was a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. I'm not quite seeing that yet. So everyone's remaining hopeful and optimistic for 2024. But it is blind optimism at the moment. So we just got a bit more of a wait and see.
Hoping those green shoots appear in Jan.
Whatever they're called. Some green lights is what I would like. Forget the green shoots. Come on, commissioners.
Nice.
Get some green lights.
Like that. And next for us, or rather sort of next to him via the internet, it's broadcast consultant Brett Spencer. Hello, Brett.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing? Very impressed with the level of decoration in the studio there. Fantastic.
It's super Christmassy, isn't it? That all of you can watch on the YouTube version of this. If you didn't know, you can watch this all on YouTube. Brett, you're closely involved in City University's podcast course. I guess you've had the first batch who are breaking for Christmas soon. How have they all been?
They're fantastic. We've an enormously engaged set of students, and you're about to see their first podcast coming out. And and we're interviewing people for next year already on the course, and it's going better than we possibly could have hoped.
Well, that's good. That sounds almost too positive. Is there anything you've
learned?
I'm
trying to bring the positive because Faraz was just bringing the bleak, to be honest. So I'm just trying to be Mr. Happy at this point. Yeah.
Good, good. Well, someone that's delivered us all an early Christmas present is Netflix, with the biggest release of viewer data, which dropped somewhat unexpectedly on Wednesday afternoon. Faraz, they've been always a little bit quiet about how their shows are doing. Obviously, post-settlement with some of the unions in America, this seems the first bit of info that's come out. What have they released?
Well, so they've given viewing data in hours viewed, if I understand it correctly, of all of their top shows. I think there's an exact number. I think it's like 18,000 hours. Anything above that, they're saying that this is kind of the hours viewed, and it's Netflix is really interesting when it starts releasing data because it shows that you've never heard of, that seem to be topping the charts. And you're a bit like, hang on a minute, what's going on here? I think that when you think of Netflix, you think of Stranger Things and The Crown and obviously at the moment Squid Game, The Challenge, etc. But actually when you look at the numbers and data they've released, it doesn't seem to be those shows that get the most heaviest promotion that necessarily are getting the most hours viewed. However, I will say this. There's a little bit of controversy around, well, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but there's a little bit of like, what does hours viewed mean? Because, you know, if you start drilling down into it, well, if you've got a show that has had 15 seasons and is very bingeable, then obviously that's going to have a lot of hours viewed. If you have a Christmas animation, for instance, that's half an hour long, that's not obviously not going to have the same amount of hours viewed. I wonder if they're going to release more types of data, like, for instance, how many times something has been rewatched. You know, if you've got kids like I do in my family, Paw Patrol has been rewatched a billion times over. Is that going to be the same hours viewed? You know, that show is 5 minutes long. So, you know, is that going to have the same hours viewed, but it's had the same number of impressions, if that makes sense. So it's viewing figures are always a bit weird. There's kind of share and there's reach and there's numbers and there's households and now there's hours viewed on top of this. And no one can really decide on what is an accurate measurement of success, as it were. I will say, all of this seems to be linked, I think, to the fact that they've now got an ad tier. So because once they had an ad tier, they obviously need to start releasing data to demonstrate this is how many views you're getting and therefore your kind of CPMs and, you know, the amount of impressions you're getting on your data. That needs to be linked to advertising, which is why they've started doing this.
Brett, have you seen The Night Agent?
I have. I've watched The Night Agent and I've read the book for a bonus point. and it's an excellent book by Matthew Quirk. And I think one of the reasons for the success of The Night Agent is it appeals to that sort of mainstream audience. So the audience that would watch NCIS and Law and Order and that sort of thing. It's very much, and the book wasn't, but the series is very much in the mold of 24 in the way they've sort of set it up to be an ongoing series. And I think that mainstream audience isn't necessarily that well catered for on streaming services, who are very much about limited series and prestige projects. And I think that's what The Night Agent has tapped into, that sort of mainstream network TV audience who are not necessarily being flooded with new content on streaming services. And that's what's led to that success. And it's made by Sean Ryan, who made The Shield, and he knows how to make a long-running, successful mainstream TV show.
It is a brilliantly, slightly schlocky crime mystery show. Anything else on there, Brett, that surprised you or things that you thought,
thing is that, you know, Netflix at the moment are in the box seat in terms of movies. They've got this month, they've got coming out May, December, which is the Julianne Moore, Todd Haynes directed movie, as well as Maestro with Bradley Cooper as Leonard Bernstein. They've also got the new Julia Roberts film, which is also based on a great book. And those films are all going to be in the Oscar race, and they're the things they're making a fuss over. But what they're not really releasing is Leave the World Behind is the Julia Roberts movie. Couldn't think of the title there. But they're not making a fuss about the data around the movies at the moment, because as Faraz just said, the numbers, because it's hours viewed, tend to skew to long-running series. So it'd be really interesting to get some data behind these movies. They seem to be using the movies to get kudos and Oscar bait rather than to promote the service or say how many people are watching them. But the filmmakers are going to want to know how many people are watching their movies in order for them to want to continue to make these prestige movies for Netflix.
Fraz, what have been your TV picks of the year?
Beef's on here, and Beef is brilliant. If you haven't seen it, it is really, really worth watching. I have just finished Squid Game, The Challenge, and there's lots of professional jealousy there. It is a brilliant, brilliant show. As I think is the case with a lot of, in particular, Netflix shows, it's too long.
Well, can I make a Squid Game, The Challenge?
Okay, go on.
So,
Hang on, are you going to shoot me in the face? Is that what's going to happen?
It would just be a squib, so
okay,
it'd be
fine,
okay.
Right, okay.
So I've watched most of it, and it looks great, and it's been made really well. I also watched Mr. Beast's Squid Game quiz version. I don't think that his version was that different to the one which went out on the telly.
Probably. I mean, look, it's brand recognition. That's a lot of it. What I think is really inspired by what they did with that is that they got The Garden involved. It was a co-production between The Garden and Studio Lambert. Studio Lambert are brilliant at making entertainment shows. The Garden are brilliant at making emotional shows. So they really did lean into kind of telling the stories of the individuals. When I watch Mr. Beast content, it's about Mr. Beast.
It's quick. It's quick.
Yeah. Mm. It's not about the people that are playing those
games. There's no time for backstory.
There's none of that. Whereas this has got some really interesting characters, and they've got a mother and a daughter in there, and they've got lots of people that have got, they set up villains and then they try and have redemption arcs for those people. There's a lot of that going on. It's very, very well made, particularly for a first season.
And it's been recommissioned for a second.
Yes. I think that, and I think it's important to note, I'm going to say this, I'm going to fly the flag. It's made by British producers because we are the best in the world at making factual content in particular. And we continue to be the best in the world at making factual content. So I hope everybody's watching that because...
Come use us more.
Exactly, come use us more. But again, the reason for it is... I'm going to get my soapbox now. But the reason for it is because of the mixed ecology of our PSBs and our commercial channels that are able to take risks and able to kind of look at telling stories in a way that's not just clickbaity and Moorish. We have got a bit more depth, in particularly in the factual content we're making.
Brett, any TV picks of the year?
Yeah, I mean, my two favourite dramas were both dramas that sort of reinvented genres. Just when you thought you couldn't do anything new in the cop genre space or the medical genre space, I thought Blue Lights on BBC was incredible. It looked on the face of it to be a sort of humdrum series about policing in Northern Ireland, and it was so much more than that. I'd recommend that to anybody. And I'm not someone that binges stuff, really. We watch stuff quite slowly, and we watched the whole of that series in two nights. And the other show, which I think we invented the medical genre, which has just been renewed for a second series, was Malpractice on ITV, which is not getting any love in the critics' end-of-year list. I think there's a bit of a snobbishness because it was an ITV drama, perhaps. And that's got an absolute nerve-shredding performance by Niamh Algar, and I'd recommend that as well. It was fantastic.
Well, speaking of TV and moving on to all three media, it looks like Jeff Zucker, who we've been talking about quite a lot, he's been doing that Telegraph deal. It looks like he is running the rule over Super Indie All Three Media. This is his investment firm, Redbird. Faraz, another £1 billion on the table from Abu Dhabi investors mainly.
The Arabs are coming.
they'd get quite a lot if they've got All Three Media. There's quite a lot of hits. What hits are in there for our audience at home?
Well, All Three Media, I think I might have mentioned The Traitors already. That's kind of part of their stable. Gogglebox is, I mean, these are, I'm already mentioned Studio Lambert shows because, I work in factual television, and they do a lot of that. Squid Game The Challenge is also made by Studio Lambert. So all of those shows have done really, really well. And, they do kind of more schlocky stuff like Midsummer Murders. They've got an incredible, they've got a very, very strong slate of current stuff, but they've also got a brilliant back catalogue as well. So, Derren Brown is part of that, Peep Show is part of it, and all of those things obviously do very, very well on inventory services like Netflix. And, we kind of skimmed over this, but actually Ted Serrano kind of said that legacy programming, what they call acquisitions or inventory programming, is still makes up at least half of everything that's on Netflix. It's not just about the new commissions, and so people that own these back catalogues can still continue to make a little bit of wedge out of them. So it's £1 billion. It's pounds, isn't it? £1 billion. ITV said no to it kind of earlier this year or late last year.
Yeah, so I was reading a bit of stuff about that, and they weren't sure whether they'd get that through their investors, even though they would be buying it sort of off one of their investors, because John Malone has a chunk of ITV and he owns a chunk of All Three. Mistake for ITV not to add it to ITV Studios?
I think that what's interesting is I've kind of made a joke about the Arabs are coming, but the amount of investment that Saudi and Abu Dhabi and Qatar are kind of building into Western media properties. They now own, I believe they own WWE. Live Golf is kind of taken over the PGA Tour, and they're kind of investing heavily into football. Saudi Arabia just won the rights to the World Cup in two cycles time, I think in 2028 or 32 or something like that, which was always going to be the way that's coming. And they are also making noises about doing a big acquisition into a video games publisher as well. So, the idea that All Three Media, Formula One, WWE, football, golf, and maybe something like Nintendo. I mean, I'm just a pure speculation, but they're all owned that by scale. One region. Mm. That is, that suddenly makes them a huge, huge player. And I think that they are interested in making big moves, and this would be a very big move. Whether I think it's a mistake for ITV not to pick it up, I don't know the answer to that. It's a bit above, it's very above my pay grade.
Brett,
Faraz, as you're the sort of the resident expert on this, I mean, clearly football fans and golf fans are really uncomfortable with the amount of money from the area that's coming into those sports. Should the audience care about this?
What, about who owns the media?
About who owns an indie like All Three Media. Should the audience care about that?
I think, look, there have been some question marks. So there was a... an issue. Well, there's two things that happened. One is the problem with Jon Stewart, which is an Apple TV show.
So that's China. Mm. He sort of said that the reason it's kind of on the way out
Correct.
Is that Apple weren't happy them going too hard on China, which is a key partner for Apple.
Correct. And and for Netflix, it was Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj. Where they had to cancel that. Well, I don't know if they had to cancel it, but they censored some shows that had criticism, I believe, about Saudi Arabia in particular. It does create a tension in the editorial because there are lots of question marks, and the Qatar World Cup was part of that, and I'm sure the Saudi World Cup will have similar question marks. That does kind of play part of it. It will be interesting.
And some of that can be chilling, just assumptions that
Correct.
Producers make, not even that they've been instructed by someone to do something.
Correct. Now, I don't know. I wish I could sit here and tell you the whole slate of what's on All Three Media. But I think if you look at what we have in the UK, when you look at things like, you know, Mawan's show with Juiced and Drag Race and I Kissed a Boy, and, you know, you look at shows that are kind of have... I'm talking about a lot of LGBT shows. Are those shows at risk if it's suddenly owned by a country that, or a region that is more conservative when it comes to LGBT rights, to say the least? There may be concerns around that. I would argue that it would be interesting to see if that kind of pushes the culture forward. Because once you get into those spaces around music and sports and in this instance, television and factual television and dramas, etc., you are going to have to kind of be a bit more liberal in your views because you're playing to a much international, you know, wider audience. I don't believe that WWE has stopped having women wrestlers.
Sure, but sometimes I think that's the hope, whether it really pushes through. Brett, would you spend £1 billion on All Three Media?
I haven't got £1 billion to spend on All Three Media. But my question about the audience was relevant because I just wondered what difference it would make on screen. I mean, you can see what difference it's making in football in that suddenly a lot of footballers are going off to play in the region. It's obviously had a big impact on what viewers see in terms of golf because you're now not getting all the top golfers playing together. So I am interested to
You are now, though, because now PGA is gone. That has reversed now. So LIV Golf has everybody now because the PGA Tour doesn't exist anymore. And I would argue for footballers, I'm not a huge football fan, but I have kind of anecdotally seen people going, amazing, Arab money is coming in and then Newcastle might win the league now. So suddenly there is a bit like, well, the money's a good thing because we need more investment into this space. So,
you're thinking purely on a drama basis.
Yeah.
Brett?
Yeah, I mean, I said the threat to football is different because their attempt to drain off the best players, if that makes sense, to go and play in leagues over there. So that's what the concern is among football fans. But whether this makes a difference to what the audience sees on screen and programmes is open to question. But as Fry says, there's a content issue there over what they might be inclined to make.
Well, speaking of football, it's kind of been a story of the year, but Gary Lineker's social media feed is back in the news. This is after the incoming BBC chair took issue with a tweet Lineker posted about a member of Parliament. Faraz, what did he tweet?
Well, he wasn't about football, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He wasn't speaking about football, which I think is what caused the controversy.
So, yeah, so he was sort of responding to Jonathan Gullis MP, wasn't he?
Yeah, so my understanding of what... There's one tweet about Grant Shapps, and then there was one about Jonathan Gullis. And Jonathan Gullis's tweet, he said something about... I think his assistant read the briefing notes for him. And then with Grant Shapps, he made a joke about the fact that Grant Shapps seems to have a million and one and like different names depending on what day of the week it is. I think that, and so the new BBC impartiality guidelines are fairly clear about this, that you can't criticise an MP. And he is, I mean, let's be honest, like Gary Lineker's making jokes about sitting MPs. Mm. It's pretty cut and sharp when he looks at that. I would argue that it's a bit silly if we're starting to kind of reprimand Lineker for making some jokes about MPs.
If you're Gary Lineker, constant tweet problems. They've invented the entire guidelines for Gary Lineker. Mm-hmm.
He's taking a mick. He's taking a mick of the guidelines and he's taking the mick out of
Yeah, and MP. Also he's saying that Jonathan Gullis hasn't read the new guidelines. Well, I'm not sure that Gary's read the new guidelines if he's doing this. And there's a bit of me that's like, the new chair...
He's not a chair yet.
The potential new chair got into quite a lot of it, I thought, where he should have come up with a bit of a, well, on the face of it, but I want to talk to the team if I become the chair. Because in effect, he's set up that he's sort of got to get rid of Gary when he when he rocks up and I think
that might be reading too much into it. And I think the problem into this is that people are reading too much into all of this stuff. Number one, no one cares about what people write on Twitter or X or anything.
MPs do it about them.
And until it gets into the press, right? So it's almost like a weird thing where Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, is almost turned into some sort of like a newswire. So no one reads the newswires, but they read what the newspapers say about it. So that's kind of what's happening here, where everyone is looking to make a media story out of something that's not there. It's a little bit, I mean, it's like, come on, Gary, what, you know, some of the jokes are quite good. It's quite a good joke that he made about Grant Shapps, which is kind of like, and the irresistible nature of Twitter is that when you have a good joke, you just want to put it out there because it's quite a good joke. And generally it disappears the day after. In Gary's instance, that's absolutely not the case because of all of the hype around him and the press wanting to kind of see him like...
Well, they want to get him. They want to get him. And I sort of feel like my view is that Gary knows he's got all this pressure on him. He is responsible for crap things that happens to the BBC because he likes to make a joke on Twitter.
Correct.
And I wish sometimes he'd have a bit more respect for the organisation and basically all the other staff who work at the organisation because he constantly causes them troubles.
Yeah.
And all he does is present a show about football once a week.
I think that's
for a lot of money.
I think that's broadly true, but I also think that as politicians, if you can't take a joke from a football pundit, like, what are you doing in politics?
I think writing social media guidelines is really hard. I mean, I certainly contributed to the writing of social media guidelines when I was at the BBC, which was sort of written by committee. And when I got to Bow, I wrote the social media guidelines for staff because there weren't any. And to actually writing them are really difficult to apply to everybody across the board. And then actually applying them in practice is incredibly difficult. And I'm not sure everybody appreciates that. And on Wednesday night at City University, we had Dorothy Burns delivering the James Cameron Memorial Lecture. And she's the former head of news and current affairs at Channel 4. And she was saying something similar to what you were just saying, which is that, you know, there's an audience now, particularly a younger audience, that are relying on social media for news. And there are many now that believe in my truth rather than an objective truth, she was saying. And what she was calling for is she was saying that ministers should make tackling misinformation on social media their priority rather than using it to attack public service broadcasters.
Sorry, in addition to that, although I don't know why I'm putting anything in addition to Dorothy Byrne, anything she says is doesn't require any addition, but here I am. Like, it's the politicians themselves that do these jokes, right? It's, you know, you look at the Tory party vice chairman, it's like, you've seen it with Nadine Dorries, it's like, you know, and if you, and that's just in the UK, in America it's even more insane.
Well, they're performers. They're performers, and they like the limelight, and that thing in their pocket, I'm talking about their phone, means that they can get those gags in front of people.
So that's, and that creates a bit of a weird imbalance, because if we're saying that politicians can do this, but if you, just because you work for the BBC, you can't do this. Well, I would argue, if you're an MP, you need to wind your neck in. Like, you know, that's kind of one of the responsibilities of being an MP. If you don't want to do that as an MP, then I don't know if you have a huge amount of criticism or space to kind of criticise other people doing it as well. It's got to be a two-way street.
I thought it was interesting in America, just picking up on that, everyone has sort of two Twitter accounts. You have sort of your official account as the representative of Delaware South, and then you also have a sort of campaigning account. I don't know, it's not a great split, but there's something that we don't really have here, and maybe the Prime Minister sort of has it, but even some of his tweets recently have been on the aggressive side.
I mean, we forget what it was like when Donald Trump had his Twitter account, like, and that wasn't separate. You know, there was a real Donald Trump, but he was also posting ridiculous things from the POTUS account as well. And this is, I think this is kind of my point, is that, like, well, they're both public money, right? These MPs are paid for with public money. Gary Lineker is paid for by public money. There seems to be a standard that, because, and I know, I understand it's to do with impartiality and etc., but they are both paid for by the public purse, and we need to kind of figure out what we're going to do here. I mean, look, X/Twitter is going to be dead by the end of next year anyway, so I don't know why anybody cares about this, because that's probably going to be the easiest way to deal with this. Whether or not he's doing this on Instagram as well, I don't know. But
well, whilst we take a break, we'll review the social media guidelines for all participants on the Media Podcast, and we'll see you both in a sec. Now, a little podcast admin for you. We're going to be taking a break now until the new year when we return for our annual predictions special. Lots of great insight coming you with that. And of course, we'll review last year's predictions to see how accurate all of our guests turned out to be. In the meantime, we have a bumper library of interviews on our Patreon to get you through the holidays. Each one packed full of insight from program makers, industry execs, and more besides. And of course, you support the making of this independent podcast. So if you value what we do here every week, please take a moment to join the Patreon. We have tiers depending on what you do, from industry leaders to those at the start of their career. Maybe send us a Christmas present. Just go to patreon.com/mediapod. That's patreon.com/mediapod.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And Fraz and Brett are back with me for some more news in brief. The Mail Online may soon have a paywall, according to owner Lord Rothmere. Brett, do we know how it's going to work?
I think they're looking at a freemium model where you'll get some stories for free and then you'll have to pay after that. And they've not made a secret. They've been looking at the success of publications elsewhere. I think Lord Rothermere quoted the success of The Telegraph. And you can see how it fits into their wider ambitions. If you look at what The Times is doing, where The Times has, you know, a digital paywall, and then they have The Times Radio as part of that to drive subscribers to it. And, of course, now launching they've just started putting some of their podcasts behind the paywall as extra value for subscribers. And you can see how The Mail will marry that to all the other things that they could potentially do around video. They've just started up a podcast division, which Jamie East is heading up, who I think you had on the other week. So you can see how they will start to tie up the various things that they're doing into something which is subscriber-based. And there's a need to do that because of the drop-off in advertising. And, you know, and The Mail, like a lot of other people, are looking to make up that shortfall.
Well, they're obviously a massive publisher. They do hugely well all over the world. Do you think they have that connection with the audience, those people who are kind of surfing the sidebar of shame, maybe who aren't like Daily Mail consumers, they're just kind of hopping on clicks and social media links. Do you think they're convertible to be subscribers?
I think the challenge they've got is that if you're subscribing to something, it's got to be something that you feel you can't live without, or you're passionate about, or you need as part of your daily content digest. And for a lot of people reading The Mail, it's just fun stuff to click through and to look at. And whether people will be prepared to pay for that remains to be seen, because the most success we've seen has been around much more serious content and journalism.
Faraz, is Boris Johnson enough of a draw to convert people into be Mail subscribers?
I'm just a little bit confused about this, because
they've got Mail Plus.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So that's not the same thing. So they're obviously launching another product on top of Mail Plus.
I think Mail Plus is very much about special things, and I think they've gone, that hasn't had the enough of a interest. They need to push it across the lot.
There is a tendency for some media organisations to do this, where they create lots of different pockets of paid for things, and I think that becomes very confusing to the end user as a result, because they're a bit like, am I a Mail Plus subscriber, or am I and actually it becomes incredibly frustrating when you do subscribe to something that's freemium like this and then you hit a new paywall under the same brand. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of like clean that up, because I think it could be quite complicated for male readers.
Well, just on that, it's interesting. Like the New York Times. So I subscribe to New York Times when I try and get like a good offer from them. But they're really pushing the upgrade for getting puzzles and cooking recipes and everything else. And I sort of feel like the only ads I get from New York Times are for them begging for more money from me.
Yeah. But that to me makes a bit more sense, because that's tiered, right? So you've got like the New York Times, get to see the headlines, but you've got to pay for there's a paywall there. Pay for the paywall, you can see the news. If you want to pay for premium products like puzzles and cooking, you pay for another tier, and that's like the all singing, all dancing, ultra package or whatever it is you want to call it. That makes sense because that's tiered. That's not what I'm understanding from this, and it'll be interesting to see how they do end up launching this. I think that this is about bundling. So I think that the reason that they're doing this is that they're trying to create the mail to be more of a premium product, so that it becomes attractive when you have news aggregators, Apple News Plus and the like, that then start looking to bundle paid for news, and they're trying to differentiate what the paper is compared to kind of what is premium content that they then can add to a mobile phone subscription or a Sky subscription or whatever, and it becomes a
wholesale option.
Exactly. Which I think is why they kind of are creating this. I'll be interested to know how many direct subscribers they'll get.
Yeah, Brett, are they just too late with it?
I'm not sure it's too late, but I think one of the things that the Mail needs to think about, like all the other publishers, is the future of news and social media. Because we've just talked about, you know, the continuing decline of X, there's ongoing issues around Facebook and their placing news. We've seen recently Canada sort of trying to break with various, you know, platforms in terms of news supply and keeping stuff within newspapers. So I think somewhere like the Mail, which is very clickbait, has got to think about, are some of those channels, online channels that bring traffic to them, going to decline further over the next year, 18 months, and decrease their traffic? So everybody's got to start looking for alternative sources of revenue.
It's a good point, isn't it, Faraz? You're trying to drive direct consumption of your content, sort of primary, now that the social platforms already are dispersing, everyone's going in different places, and even the click-through rates have always been pretty dreadful from them as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the great, you know, if we were to, when we reevaluate what happened in the last, you know, social media age, the thing that a lot of people who make content have realized is that it was a scam, because you gave so much of your content away for free to YouTube and Twitter, and they made lots of money and built their platforms off the back of people basically giving them content without even having to ask for it. And some of the best ideas, some of the best journalists, some of them made a really great living out of it, but a lot of the time it was journalists kind of trialing ideas out and headlines, stories, etc. And if one went viral, then they'd write a full story, but it'd be interesting to know how many people actually read the full story because they've already seen the tweet. So that's kind of there's a bit of a reckoning around that, and I guess a bit of course correction. I think my view on this is that the reason this is coming out now is because next year is going to be about nothing but elections. And, you know, Boris's view on that, and I imagine Nadine's view on that, and whoever else leaves the Tory party or any other party for that matter before the election, is going to be interesting. You know, I subscribed to New York Times during the presidential election of Hillary Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and that's when I took my subscription out. I've kept it ever since then, and I think that a lot of these places are seeing the American election and the UK election being a time when people are going to want to heavily consume news to see the circus that's going to come into town and get some reporting around it.
We're talking about money there, and magazine publisher Future has not had the best year according to its annual report. Profits before tax were down 19% year on year. But the group's bucking the trend in press, announcing a £25 million investment programme that will see it hire 150 new editorial staff, according to the Press Gazette. Brett, do we know what the money's being used for?
Well, they're trying to move further into the US, and they're trying to focus more on reviews, and that's something that leans very well into search and to SEO when you're looking for a review of a particular product. So that's where they think there's money to be made, and this is yet another example of a company who are looking to gain money from different avenues when advertising has dropped off. And interesting that all the things that we've talked about today, whether it be Netflix, whether it be the Mail or the Times or Future, is all about sort of, you know, trying to reach new audience, to increase that money. And there's only a certain limited amount of money, whether it be audience money that you're seeking, whether it be advertiser money. You know, everybody's chasing what seems to be an ever decreasing smaller part. And without wishing to sound as bleak as Faraz did at the beginning of the beginning of the program, you know, there are a lot of people chasing the same digital dimes, as we used to call them when digital started to first emerge, and we're seeing that come around again at the moment.
I mean, for us, there's sometimes I look at this and go, it's scary. Advertising's had a tough year. It's sort of seeming to pick up a little bit, but at least there are opportunities for publishers and media owners to diversify and to look at different revenue streams. That's not all bad news, is it?
There are, and I think the review thing is really interesting because obviously Future have got a number of titles that are trusted by audiences. So when they say something is good, it's got this kind of like, you know, seal of approval attached to it. One thing I would be interested to see is if they are going to start creating personalities based around this. And the reason I say that is, you know, when you look at review sites, there is one that is, you know, arguably the gold standard, which is Wirecutter, that got acquired by the New York Times, and they were the first on this and have done very, very well out of it. But actually, if you look at the new trend of review sites, so I'm talking about Top Jaw, I'm talking about Cult Flav, you know, there are TikTok channels that are kind of being, that are quite premium TikTok channels that are doing reviews, and some of them are like legacy brands like Good Housekeeping and America Test Kitchen. You know, these are all great review sites. They are all based around personalities. And so while you've got the brand that exists there, you're seeing recognizable faces that come up again and again. And actually, the way that social in particular works and video works is that you're going to need those personalities to effectively represent the brand.
Well, is this kind of new content creators jumping on the opportunities kind of faster than legacy media operators? No surprise there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at TikTok, the amount of TikTok shopping they're pushing, particularly, I guess, at the moment for Christmas. Mm-hmm. I mean, seemingly every third video has a buy button on it.
Well, I think TikTok shopping is slightly different because I think that is TikTok themselves pushing
That's content providers being affiliates and being able to add products to their videos. Yeah,
but endorsed by TikTok themselves. So TikTok are trying to build a model where they create user behavior where you click through and buy something.
If I see another ad for that Breville toaster you put in the microwave...
I haven't seen that. Well, okay, show your algorithm compared to my algorithm. Yeah. I'm not putting any toasters in a microwave. That sounds like a health hazard right there.
Apparently it works very well. You should have a look.
This is going to be on my algorithm on the way home now. My phone's picked it up and it's a bit like, guess what we're going to be showing you on the way home. But what I have started to see are, like I said, lots of personality-led review sites of restaurants and of food. I'm just obviously very hungry at the moment, which is why I'm getting a lot of cooking stuff. But also video games and music and hi-fi equipment and cars. You know, the CarWow site is, I forget the name of the guy, but the guy that runs the CarWow website has become bigger than the brand itself. That whole kind of thing about personality and tone of voice is where these magazines need to get that right. I think that for a long time, legacy magazine journalism didn't invest heavily enough in their reporters and their tone of voice and who they are. So my thought is that they're going to hire some people that can represent the brand in the best way, and that's what's going to get them.
I was going to say, it'd be interesting who's writing this stuff because, you know, magazines now have such small staffs. You know, a lot of magazines you read just have two or three staff writers and are just run by freelancers, effectively, who are supplying them with content. So, you know, if they're going to be upping their content, it'll be interesting to see, you know, where that's going to come from. Are they going to be, you know, creating better deals for freelancers who we constantly see on social media about not being paid on time? I'm not saying that's a fault with Future. I just mean in general, because magazines have been sort of run down and signed to staff such a long period of time now.
And all that staff are pissing around doing podcasts, aren't they? It's a bit like, stop getting out of the mics and write something.
You say that as a joke, but you know, when Tina Brown came to speak at City University last year, she said the future of magazines is podcasting. You know, the future of journalism and content is in
audio. Personalities.
Back to relationships with audiences, isn't
correct.
It? You know, great magazines have always had great relationships with their audience. When you look at the mags that are successful, though, it tends to be ones that are pretty deep. So, like, Private Eye is one of the most successful mags in the country, and that does something very different to everybody else and gives a different viewpoint. And I think if you probably read that, you feel part of that club. We're not going to Double H Smiths as much as we used to and grazing over that content when we've got loads of content.
But, Private Eye has an incredible tone of voice. You buy it because it's funny. And it breaks stories as well. And I don't know if these magazines, because of the staff that have been cut along the way, they are just effectively churning out pack shots of products and press releases and putting their own spin on it. And actually, what is missing is that personality and that tone of voice. So if we are going to get a bit of investment in that direction, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing at all.
Right, just time for the media quiz this week entitled Play Your Streams Right. Yes, it's an old-fashioned game of higher or lower using the latest viewing data from Netflix. We've talked a little bit about it already. You tell me if the shows I name have higher or lower viewing hours than the previous show. So let's play Your Streams Right. The first show is Luther, The Fallen Son, which had 209 million hours viewed worldwide. That's your baseline. Question number one. Brett, the show is Emily in Paris. Is it higher or lower?
Blimey, lower.
That's right. It's lower, 161 million hours. Faraz, Black Mirror Season 6, higher or lower than Emily in Paris?
It's got to be higher, surely.
You'd think, but it's lower, 139 million. It's the 54th biggest series in the world, though higher in the UK. Brett, Love is Blind Season 4, higher or lower?
Higher or lower than
Black Mirror Season 6.
Higher.
It is higher, 229 million, the 17th in the world. Right, back to you, Faraz. Wednesday, season one, higher or lower than Love is Blind?
That is a good question. I'm going to say lower.
It's higher, 507 million hours. Well done to the TV expert. You sadly did not win. Brett, congratulations. As your prize, you'll be devising the media podcast, The Magazine, out later next year. My thanks to Brett Spencer and Faraz Osman. Faraz, where can listeners keep up with what you're doing?
Not on Twitter anymore. I haven't tweeted in ages. So
are you off?
I'm not off. I just can't be arsed anymore. But on the socials, I am Fosman, my ongoing joke, somebody nicked Faraz Osman on both threads and Instagram. It makes me very cross. Please don't follow him. Follow me, which is F Osman on that. And the company is gold_Weller on everything.
And Brett, how about you?
I'm Brett Assar on X and all other platforms. Please also follow City Journalism on various platforms as well. I have to mention that the course is open for applications for next year. And you can also find stuff that I'm working on at Spirit Land Productions.
Excellent. Thank you both. Have a great Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And that's it from us today at the London Podcast Studios. Remember, you can get 25% off your first booking at this lovely place when you use the code MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com. That's MEDIAPOD at thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off. And of course, if you're new to the show, why not hit follow to get us in your ears all year round? And we are also on YouTube if you want to see my beautiful face as well. Podfollow.com/themediapodcast will take you to us in the apps. Just search for The Media Podcast on YouTube to find us there. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Ollie Pitt and Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year when we'll see you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.